and welcome to Literary Loitering, the Geek Show's dedicated show to all things book-related here on the Geek Show Podcast Network. I'm Andrew, and once again, I am joined by Rob.
Hello.
That's Rob. And we have got plenty of exciting books and art news, and even a book review to kick the new year off.
Well, we have two.
Yes, we do. Two book reviews.
Wow. Now, we're going to have a lot more book reviews this year. It's going to be a great year for us, for our reading material. So, yes, I've got a really good one. You've got a really good one. Fantastic start to the year.
Happy days.
Yes, it's a fantastic start to the year for us, but not so much for the Oxford Literary Festival.
Oh, nice segue.
Yes. And now, the Oxford Literary Festival, very prestigious festival. But sadly, it has just lost one of its patrons, and the patron it's lost is the wonderful Philip Pullman, the author of the His Dark Materials series.
So you could say he's pulled out.
Oh, that's my level of joke. You're not supposed to do that. You're stealing my work. I don't know. Coming over here, taking our jobs. Anyway, Philip Pullman has pulled out as patron of the Oxford Literary Festival. For one reason, and it is in protest, because he is frankly sick to death and disgusted at the Literary Festival's refusal, continued refusal, to pay guest speakers and authors who attend. Now, I actually agree with him. If you're going to get somebody to go to a festival...
Yeah, you got to pay them. That's just basic business.
You can't ask them to go there and do it for nothing. Especially if you're charging an admission fee.
Oh, do they charge an admission fee?
Well, if it was a free festival, I could understand. But even if it isn't, you know, the council is usually involved and gives you a budget. So you should be able to assign some funds. If the author is willing to do it for free, off their own back.
Yeah, that's all well and good. But, like, you shouldn't assume they're going to do it for free.
Yeah, at least give them the choice.
Yeah.
You know, make them understand. If you have a limited budget, just basically say to them, look, we do have a limited budget. We make every effort to pay our guest speakers, but if you could do it for free, that would be wonderful. If you were willing to donate your time to this, you know, off your own back, that would be amazing. And generally, in terms of the promotional aspect and the publicity, most authors would probably say yes, but at least give them the choice.
Yeah, because it is their time that's being taken up.
Exactly. And if the author has a choice, I think if they'd given the author the choice, I don't think Pullman would have pulled out.
Yeah, no, I think it's just the lack of choice that he's protesting.
If it's an arbitrary, we're not going to pay anybody, then yeah, I can totally understand why he's refused to be patron for it anymore. So yeah, he's been a patron of the Literary Festival, one of the UK's biggest, for the past 5 years. But... yeah, it's refusal to pay authors puts him in an awkward position, in his words, as he is also the president of the Society of Authors, which campaigns for author pay at such events.
Yeah, well, that has to be why he's pulled out then.
Yeah. According to Pullman, he realizes he needed to resolve the issue, so he decided to step down as patron from the festival. Authors are the centre of the festival, and the only reason people buy tickets in the first place, so is a ticketed event, is to see the authors. It's only just that they should be paid. Other festivals pay, and the Oxford Festival pays everyone else involved, from the cleaners to the people who put up the marquees.
Yeah, but then that's ridiculous. The authors themselves are the only ones not paid.
Especially if it's a ticketed event.
Yeah.
You know, if it was a free event, like the Middlesbrough Literary Festival, there's certain aspects to it that you have to pay to go see the actual authors. But there are others that are free, right? It's a mix and match of both. But if this is a ticketed event, if you have a ticket and you have to go in, you have to buy a ticket to go, basically go in and see the authors, and they have marquees and everything like that set up. You know, like Hayes is set up.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's all in one enclosed thing. It's not spread out across the town. Or anything like that. If it's set up like that, then, yeah, the authors need to be paid. Firmly on the side of the authors here.
Yeah, so yeah, we definitely support Philip Pullman's decision to stand down.
Yeah, I can't agree with him more. He's a great author as well, by the way. Just in case you were wondering, His Dark Materials is...
If you're listening, Phil, we're fans.
Yes.
Big thumbs up.
His Dark Materials is better than Harry Potter.
Ooh.
I went there.
Well, we managed to get, like, 5 whole minutes into this year without setting another group of people onto the list.
What, Harry Potter fans?
Actually, I'm pretty sure they're already on the list, so it's fine.
Yes.
No. We've just re-insulted people we've insulted before.
Well, I wasn't insulting them. I was just saying that His Dark Materials, the trilogy, well, yeah, is better than Harry Potter.
But to them, like, saying anything is better than Harry Potter is just... Like, you can't say, like, 1984 was better than Harry Potter.
Well, it is. It's very different, but it is. But it isn't, but it is. 1984 was a lot more predictive than Harry Potter
How
is.
How dare you say that a work of literary genius is better than a series of trumped-up children's books?
That are influenced by all sorts of other things. Ender's Game, Neil Gaiman's graphic novel, Books of Magic, Tim Hunter from Books of Magic. Have you read Books of Magic?
I've not read Books of Magic, but I know who Tim Hunter is. He's like the guy with glasses who's like the backup wizard of the universe.
Yes, and he has an owl as a familiar as well. Now, I have Books of Magic at home, so I will bring it in so you can read it. And
does Detective Chimp appear in that?
I think so.
Is it like heard of the... seen him around places.
I think he appears not in Books of Magic, but in one of the later volumes, because there's a series for Books of Magic.
Right.
It was only the first one that was written by Gaiman. I think maybe he was involved in a couple of the others, but the first one definitely was written by Gaiman. Now, yeah, Tim Hunter is an obvious influence for Harry Potter, and anybody who denies it is basically kidding themselves, because it's so obvious.
I'll have to read that.
Especially when you look at Tim Hunter's home environment as well.
Is it like literally just straight up cupboard and the stairs, abusive step-parents type deal?
Well, not quite that, but it's close. It's basically parents who don't really care. He basically ends up just living in a house where he really doesn't matter, which is almost the same.
Yeah, that is very Harry Potter-esque.
Yep. Only before Harry Potter. But have you seen that theory about, you know, they were saying Harry Potter was the chosen one? There was supposed to be this prophecy about defeating the Dark Lord.
I know, blah, 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 prophecy, chosen one.
Yeah, but have you seen the theory about it, about how there wasn't one, there were two?
I don't think so.
Apparently, what was the other one? I forgot his name. He was the one who killed the snake.
Neville Longbottom. I've seen lots of things about how Neville Longbottom should have been the chosen one, and that would have been a much better ending, and I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, but there's a theory that actually says that, because it says it gives you a specific date in the prophecy. It actually says twice in the prophecy he's going to be born at the end of as the seventh month dies. Neville Longbottom and Harry Potter were born one day apart, right? And the idea is that Harry couldn't have done it without Neville, and Neville couldn't have done it without Harry. They were basically two chosen ones, not one. Because at the end, when Harry's fighting Voldemort, where's the snake?
It's getting decapitated by Neville Longbottom.
Yeah, and according to the prophecy, only the chosen one can defeat Voldemort.
Yeah, and I guess it is part of... But then wouldn't that make, like, Ron and Hermione... the chosen ones as well, since they also helped defeat Voldemort.
Well, no, because they never actually went up against a piece of Voldemort directly, did they?
No, I'm pretty sure I think Ron at least destroyed a Horcrux, didn't he?
He destroyed a Horcrux, but most of the work had already been done. All he had to do was destroy it.
He still killed a bit of Voldemort's soul.
Yeah, true. So that puts a hole in that one then. Damn it. It was a good idea.
Blown
until
by
it. Boom. Ouch. I felt that one. Oh, well. It was a good idea until then.
It was.
Because, he kills the snake, and it's much more impressive than swinging a sword on a locket, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I want Neville Longbottom to be the chosen one.
Yeah,
it's
I
like,
don't see
he's
why.
The dorky guy with, like, the two big teeth who just doesn't fit in.
Do you know what
That's who I want to save the world.
Do you know what the really funny thing is, though? Everyone's going, Neville Longbottom, you mean the goofy kid in the first movie who tried to stop them going after the Philosopher's Stone? Like, yeah, have you seen him now? And everyone's going, ooh.
Yeah, sexy Neville Longbottom is not a thing I ever expected to live to see.
No, it's
but
just...
this is the world we live in now.
It's just the weirdest thing. He's like some kind of catalogue model or runway model or something like that now. He's kind of, I remember when he was little and fat. Exactly.
It's so strange to look at.
You just get it. No, it doesn't work. Because when you look at Daniel Radcliffe, He just looks like this, looks the same, but older.
Yeah, he's just basically like taller, young Daniel Radcliffe.
Exactly. And if you look at Rupert Grint, he's kind of the same, just, you know, taller.
Yeah, you can tell like he's aged a little bit.
Yeah. And I've forgotten who the actress is for Hermione Granger. Emma Watson?
Yeah, Emma Watson.
Emma Watson. Okay, she's changed a lot since the first appearance in Harry Potter. Hair's a lot shorter for a start. But...
yeah, well, Neville Longbottom's, explosive.
Yeah, Neville Longbottom's transformation since his first appearance in Harry Potter has been just the most amazing transformation. He's gone from, you know, short fat kid to... that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Basically, Neville Longbottom is like the anti-ugly person in that he fell out of the sexy tree and hit every branch on the way down.
Yes. No, no, he was eating a Snickers in the sexy tree and then fell out. Next thing you know, he's like taller, thinner, more muscular, handsome features.
Because he got some nuts.
Yes, exactly. He's looking around, he's going... was the ground always so far away? So, yes. Sexy Neville Longbottom is a good way to end that story. Moving on to the first UK festival dedicated to black and minority ethnic writers is going to debut next month. Yes.
Whereabouts is this going to be?
It's going to start in February, and it's going to be based around London on the 26th and the 27th of February. And the concept of Bear Lit, as it's called, is basically the concept, which features names including award-winning Xiaolu Guo, was sparked by the writers Courtier Newland and Sunny Singh, who mentioned to Samantha Asumadu, the founder of Media Diversified, a non-profit organization dedicated to promoting writers of color, that they were rarely invited to literary festivals, which I think is actually a travesty.
Yeah, well, I think... we've mentioned it on multiple shows that just these writers aren't getting the recognition they deserve.
Yeah. So I am all for Bear Lit. I think that they could have maybe chosen a better name than Bear Lit, because bear is not spelt as in the hairy bear type, you know, does it poo in the woods type thing. This is the bear as in, you know, naked.
So they're all going to be naked at the festival?
I don't think so.
So when I show up just with Mighty Wizard staff in full display, am I going to have horrifically misunderstood the situation?
Yes.
Oh, I'm less excited now.
Yes. And when Spread the Word, a report into diversity in publishing, found last April that just 4% of writers appearing at Edinburgh, Cheltenham and Hayes festivals were BAME authors, it seemed imperative to do something, said Asumadu. February's inaugural event will feature appearances from writers, including poet Jane Yeh, young poet laureate for London Selina Nuolu, and the journalist and fiction author Robin Yassin Kassab, with events to range from What It Means to Be a Writer of Colour Today to the panel's Second Generation Poets in Exile and Sci-Fi versus Afrofuturism. I want to go there. I want to go.
You had me at Afrofuturism.
I'm sorry, but that sounds like the most amazing panel. I really want to go now.
So yeah, I'm just imagining like just Shaft wearing like Geordie LaForge's Star Trek visor.
Yes. And instead of the Isaac Hayes theme tune, it's been, you know, it's gone dubstep. Wow, da 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 da, wow, wow. So yes,
we've just created the greatest detective in all of fiction.
Yes, he can see through time. Who knows? Maybe. So yes, that panel just sounds amazing. Sci-fi versus Afrofuturism. I have no words.
I know.
It's like my inner nerd just exploded all over the place.
I'm excited, but also sad that there's no way we're ever going to get to see this.
Don't count your chickens before they've hatched. There's always a way where there's a will. And if not, then it'll be on YouTube. You can be guaranteed it.
Oh, that's true. It might be. But, you know, if anyone from Bear Lit is listening, we are very interested, and I will be dressed appropriately. By which I mean not at all.
Right, anyway, Bearlit's racially and globally conscious ethos is in part a reaction to the overwhelmingly homogenous view of contemporary writing presented by the UK literary festivals, said Media Diversified. The creation of Bearlit is a step toward empowering these voices that are so often silenced in the literary mainstream. So, hooray for diversity.
Yes, hooray indeed.
Now, if any of the other literary festivals had a panel that was sci-fi versus Afrofuturism, I would have gone in a heartbeat.
I think this is just what all the festivals need. That's how they get attendance up.
Yeah, sci-fi versus Afrofuturism. You know, have another panel. Have another panel, you know.
I could just have like a sci-fi versus Astrofuturism festival.
Afrofuturism.
I said astro. Oh.
You got it wrong.
I did got it wrong.
So, yes. Just why not have these mashup panels, you know? Why not just have, how does reggae fit into Lord of the Rings, for example?
Chicklet versus existential nihilism.
Yes. That would be an amazing panel.
More importantly, I think we've just worked out the next series of epic rap battles of history.
Oh, God, yes. So, yeah. Right. Moving on to another epic rap battle of history.
Yes.
You segued.
I did.
You set me up nicely. Another epic rap battle of history. They've long been acknowledged as the national bards of England and Scotland. But now, William Shakespeare and Robert Burns are going to go head-to-head for the first time ever, it's believed, in an academic conference to consider the work of both men. This is basically the equivalent of the Rumble in the Jungle, Foreman versus Ali.
But much, much nerdier.
Yeah, much, much nerdier and more artsy. With a lot more flowers and flowing robes. And a lot more, you know, wherefore art thou and stuff like that. I don't think the
world. I feel like Ali would actually fit in there really nicely.
Yes. I'm so bad, I make medicine sick. Yes, I float like a butterfly and stings like when I pee.
That is motto later on in life.
Now, that was the Peter Griffin one, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So, yes. It's being staged today, 9 days before Burns Night, and this year...
I think we should just classify, is the 16th is when we're recording this.
The 16th, it's being staged today, the 16th of January, 9 days before Burns Night, and this year actually marks 400 years since the death of Shakespeare.
Wow.
Yeah. The event will shine a light on how the Bard of Stratford-upon-Avon, or the Bard of Avon as he's more commonly known... influenced the work of Scotland's most famous poet. It will also examine the two men's roles in the development of English and Scottish national identities, a much-debated subject in the wake of 2014's independence referendum. So, yeah, Shakespeare's work is known to have played an important role in the education of Burns, who is likely to have seen his plays in local theatres. He made frequent references to the playwright in his letters to friends, quoting lines from Othello and Romeo and Juliet. And his 1786 poem, A Winter Night, was also directly inspired by King Lear. And according to one famous anecdote, as a young boy, he was so moved and shocked by the violence in Titus Andronicus that he suggested the play should be burned.
Robert Burns suggested something like a work of art should be burned.
Well, he was a kid.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
Yeah, so it was an overreaction. But, okay, I can understand it's going to be a bit dry. Because it is an academic debate, but it would be interesting to sit in on it for a little bit.
Yeah, we probably couldn't get through the whole thing.
Do you know what I think, though? I have this mental image that there's going to be, like, the Spearites, as we'll call them, and then the Burnsites on the other side, and they'll be, like, Bieber fans and, what's the other one called, One Direction fans?
You mean Beliebers and One Directioners, Rob? God, get the terminology right.
Yeah, that's it. Beliebers and One Directioners. And they'll basically, it'll be more like a gang battle.
And by gang battle, I assume you mean, as always, West Side Story musical gang battle.
Yes, kick, step, kick, turn. I might call this episode that.
I think you should.
So, yes, with all the...
The finger snapping. That was the menacingly sashay down the street.
No, no, it's manly dancing. It's manly, and we shall dance for the people. No, we won't. But yes, it is. I just have this mental image that there's going to be all these kind of dry, dusty academics who are going to be talking passionately about Shakespeare while they're wearing T-shirts and, you know, maybe headscarves and have, like, signage saying, you know, I don't know, wherever art thou, Shakespeare, and stuff like that.
So, yeah, I always like to imagine these things just as, like, some sort of Phoenix Wright type scenario.
Yes.
Just people standing up and screaming, "Objection!"
Yeah.
And somehow big red letters be in the sky.
Yes. So, yeah, Burns was from the Powdered Wig era, wasn't he?
Yes, I believe he was.
So on one side, Burnsides are going to have powdered wigs, which means,
versus tights.
No, no, wigs versus Jacobean ruffs.
Yes. Oh my God, just brutal fighting has broken out today between the wigs and the ruffs.
Yes. There's the episode title. Wigs versus ruffs. Yeah. I really want to go now. If it's anything like that, imagine.
I feel like we set the bar too high now.
No. Oh, yeah.
It's just going to be a bunch of academics sitting around discussing works of literature, and we're going to be at the back for being fight, 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 fight.
No, no. We arrive with boxes of powdered wigs and Jacobean ruffs. Like, would you mind just wearing these while you debate? And we basically just put like a chemical into the air that makes them want to fight. And then we sit back with popcorn.
I like it.
Just one of the Spearites with a copy of A Midsummer Night's Dream, just hitting one of the Burnsites on the head going, "What light from yonder window breaks?"
It's going to be beautiful.
If it was like that, it'd be amazing. I would love to see that. Maybe at some point in the future, maybe 1,000 years from now, that's how academic debates will be settled.
What, and just the embers of dying civilization?
No, no, I believe it'll be a more enlightened civilization that will look back on all of this nonsense and go, yes, nope, everything can be settled with a fight.
You primitives and your foolish talking about your problems.
Yes, let's just be straight with everybody. You're upset because he's not as good as he says he is. You're upset because he's not as good as he says he is. So why don't you fight it out? The winner gets to be the right one. Victory is, history is written by the victors after all. I reckon in the future that's going to be the creed of the world. History is written by the victors, so everyone's going to be in a fight.
So we could maybe get to see Robert Burns' "Oh, what a silly poopy butthead I am."
Yes. And Shakespeare's epic play, "My Dad's Bigger Than Your Dad." Yes. Anyway, moving on. Because
we really know that the Afrofuturists are going to be all of them.
Yes, they are. Well, they've got the greatest detective in the world.
Exactly.
In history on their side.
Oh, God, it's RoboShaft.
Yes. That just sounds wrong. I'm not even going to say what that sounds like. Anyway, moving on from our slightly absurdist humour there to something that we actually both agree on for a change, because it doesn't happen often.
Maybe because you're wrong about everything.
I'm not wrong. I'm half right.
And I'm the other half right, but mine is the better half.
Okay. Anyway, right, there's a petition that has been launched to name a new element after Terry Pratchett's Colour of Magic. And we don't mean the book. Now, as any Discworld fans know, magic has a particular colour that can only be seen by witches, wizards and cats. Because this article forgot about the witches.
It did. That's some blatant sexism article.
Yes. The colour is called octarine, and it is the 8th colour of the rainbow, the invisible one. It is somewhere after infra-black. And infra-black, as if I remember the description correctly, infra-black is the colour that is seen behind the eyes after you run really fast headfirst into a wall and just before you die.
Yes, that's it.
That is Infrablack. And after Infrablack is Octarine. Octarine is basically invisible to most people, and it appears in random places at random times. Now, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry announced the verification of the discoveries of four new chemical elements earlier in the week, and they're currently known as elements 113, 115, 117, and 118. For some reason, I don't know why, 114 and 116 are already taken or gone. Not sure. And they're going to be officially named by the teams that discovered them in the months to come. But chemist Dr. Kat Day, who blogs at the Chronicle Flask, has put in an early bid for element 117 to be named Octarine. And it has 12,000 signatures in 2 days.
Which is excellent.
Yes.
This needs to happen.
This petition is to name element 117, recently confirmed by the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry as Octarine, as the proposed symbolic OC, pronounced OOK, in honour of the late Terry Pratchett and his Discworld series of books. And I love the fact that he's gone with the OOK.
Yes, because that's what the librarian says. That is brilliant.
Yes. She wrote that in the petition to the scientists who discovered the element. At the time of writing, 2 days after it was launched, the bid had already garnered 12,851 signatories, as well as the support of the late author's Twitter feed, Terry at Terry and Rob, which is now run by his assistant, Rob Wilkins. Name element 117 Octarine. If you think that's a good idea, and we do, please sign the petition here. And we do think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to sign this petition as well.
Well, I am just bringing up the petition because I want to know how many have signed it so far. Let's see. Wow! Wow, 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 wow. Well, this article is not a recent one. It's about a week old.
So I assume it's gone up a little bit since then.
Just a little bit. 46,279.
Well then, that's a smidge more than a little bit.
Yes, it needs another 3,721 to reach 50,000.
Well, I know it's getting two more.
Yes, it's definitely getting two more. So 46,279 signatures so far. That's a lot. I don't know what to say to this, but I'm happy.
Yeah, this is... I might even go as far as to say this news has made my day.
Yes. Finally, we'll have an element called Octarine, maybe. I'm hoping that the scientists actually listen to the... Hopefully, by the time this petition ends, 50,000 people, at least. So, yeah. Anyway, moving on to our final bit of news. And this isn't so much a bit of news as something we've noticed as well. The publishing platform Flipsnack has done a calculation based on the average length of the most popular and acclaimed books published in 2014, and it has found that the average length of those books is 407 pages, which is up by 87 pages from 320 in 1999. Basically, books are getting longer. Sorry, I'm not winking at you. I've got something in my eye.
I was getting worried, Rob.
My eye was just going really funny there. So, books are getting longer, and we've noticed this with the books that we've
I feel like
today.
The books we've really gone up from like a bit over 300 to 400 to 500 pages.
Well, this book here that I've got, which I'm not going to say the name of until we review it, is what? 602 pages.
Yeah, that's pretty long. Mine is 511 pages.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely on the up and up.
So, who do we blame for this?
I'm tempted to swivel my gaze once again towards J.K. Rowling.
I don't think J.K. Rowling is to blame. To be honest, I think part of the blame lies with Robert Jordan and J.V. Jones and authors like that, because they did the long series of really thick books.
Yeah, and now that's what's popular.
Yeah. I think that's what caused the resurgence was Robert Jordan doing the Wheel of Time series and J.V. Jones doing that Baker's Boy stuff. And then you had other authors jumping on the bandwagon doing these really, really thick books. But a lot of the authors who do these thick books, they tend to waffle quite a lot. They don't really stick to the story. At least Jordan had the story moving on. He had multiple protagonists, and each of these protagonists had their own story to tell, and he was trying to cover all of it in his series, which is why they ended up as lots of thick books in a series.
Yeah, I think it really is something authors need to think about, is just, do their books need to be as long as they are?
Yeah, can they tighten the story up in any way? I think editors as well need to actually think about this seriously, because at the end of the day, how much of that book can be cut away in the editing process? How much of it can be reduced? How much of the story can be compacted? Do you need to know the colours of all of the outfits that the protagonist has in their wardrobe,
yes,
for example?
Right down to their long johns.
Exactly. Is that necessary information to drive the story forward? Probably not.
Yeah, but it is the culture of everything has to be long and overly described.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can infer a lot. When people aren't stupid, people who read especially aren't stupid in general.
Yes, I know two who are very stupid but read a lot.
Me and you?
Yes.
I was thinking, is he talking about us?
Yeah, I'm talking about us, as always.
Yes. Anyway, yeah, I think that's, it's not just authors, it's editors as well. Editors need to really knuckle down and say, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah, because, I mean, that is basically what their job is.
Yeah.
Is to decide, can this be tightened down?
Yeah. And a good editor will basically work with the author and actually go through the text with them and say, okay, this is how you need to do things. So, yeah, I think it's incumbent on editors and authors to work together to reduce the length of these books, because at the end of the day, people aren't reading as much. We know that reading figures have fallen, and they've fluctuated around the same level for a while, but they've also taken a little dip. The Kindle then raised it again, but then it's dipping again because people have got used to the Kindle, and it was a new thing. People read a lot more on the Kindle, and then all of a sudden it's taking a dip again. And I think that when you look at the length of a novel, it can be intimidating.
Yeah, it is a fairly big commitment to get behind.
Exactly. And I think that with the advent of all these really high-quality TV shows as well, people are just thinking, well, we'll just wait for the TV adaptation.
Yeah, because a lot of the big things do seem to either get a TV or a movie adaptation.
Exactly. So they just wait for that and watch TV instead of reading. But if you make the book a lot, if you make the book smaller, it becomes a lot more accessible. And I think that authors need to understand that that is a thing. You don't have to tell it all or tell the entire story in one book.
Yeah, well, basically you end up with like the situation you get with a lot of online books.
Yeah.
Where it's just probably some sort of American teenagers going, well, I have a great idea for a story, so I'm going to write like 10,000 pages and people will love it.
It's actually quite interesting you say that, because there are a lot of these online web novels, they call them, from over Japan, Korea, China, that sort of thing. And I've read quite a few. And we were meant to have this discussion at some point last year.
Yeah, we kept meaning to have this discussion on like each show, and then it doesn't happen.
So we will at some point have this discussion. But I've read quite a lot of them. And one of the ones that I've just finished reading, and it's the translations of it haven't finished, and it hasn't even been licensed in the West. It was called Arifureta, and it's about a classroom of high school kids, and they get transported to another world, and they're all given these various abilities, and one of the guys in the classroom, his name is Nagumo Hajime, and he is given the ability of synthesis.
Combining like a plant.
Combining materials together, that sort of synthesis. Anyway, he's considered fairly useless because everybody's stats are in the hundreds. They've got these status plates that shows you what their like strength and everything like that. It's a bit of gamification kind of thing. Everyone else's stats are in the hundreds. His are only 10 across the board. He's basically the equivalent of just a commoner from the world they've been transported to. One of the pretty girls in class quite likes him, has liked him for a long time, and that gets noticed by one of the jealous element in the class. So on their first dungeon mission, he ends up saving all of the class by using his synthesis ability in a very creative way, a way that nobody have actually thought of, because they're up against Behemoth, a really, really big bad monster. And as he's running back, one of his classmates hits him with a fireball, knocks him off a bridge, down into the abyss kind of thing. And he falls into the labyrinth below the labyrinth they were in. Because everyone thinks that the dungeon they're in is the actual dungeon, but he actually falls into the proper dungeon. The other thing is just, it's a mask.
Yeah, basically like the pre-dungeon.
Yeah, it's basically like tutorial mode. He falls into the proper dungeon, which isn't, it doesn't have like these stone walls and bridges and stuff like that. It's all just caves. And in that place, he loses an eye and an arm, and he's basically starving to death, and then something inside him breaks. Something snaps, and he realizes that the only way for him to survive is to kill. And he just becomes a monster in that place. Whatever was left of the human boy disappears, and he becomes this killing machine. And the only thing that saves him from falling into becoming an actual dyed-in-the-wool monster is that he saves a girl who's been trapped in that dungeon for 300 years, a vampire girl, and it's because of her friendship, which eventually turns into an actual relationship between the two of them. But because of her, he manages to retain that little spark of humanity, but he has an artificial arm, and he has a magic stone for an eye, and his hair's turned white. When he leaves the abyss, he is basically the equivalent of nothing else in the world. The only thing that could probably take him on are the servants, the direct servants of God and God itself. But he...
Yeah, okay, that sounds pretty cool.
Well, the thing is, he has one creed. If you're not my friend, you're my enemy, and I kill my enemies.
Damn.
Yeah. And it was a really good idea, really great concept, and the story was really well written, but it was long, and we're talking like 279 chapters.
Yeah, and just most people do not have time for that.
Exactly. It's a commitment that most people can't fall into, and it's not just here in the Western world that that long series thing, the long, you know, the large novel thing is happening. It's over in the East as well. And it just seems like authors, writers across the board have an inability to keep a story short.
Yeah, because I think it's that they feel long is the same as good.
It's not, though. I refer it as...
Well, not in this sense, ladies.
Yes. Yes.
And also Oscar Isaac.
Yes. What he said. Anyway, right. We shall leave it there then. And we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we will be into some books. Maybe.
Yes we will.
Hello, and I'm Lewis from Keyframe, the geek show's coolest and most composed anime podcast. Just like an anime protagonist. No, we're crazy as heck, but watch us anyway. You'll like it. Trust me. That first bit was a lie.
Hi, and welcome back to Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated books and art show. We're going to get into some books now, and we're going to start off with Andy.
Yes.
Andrew, even.
You nearly had it this time. I nearly introduced it right.
So close.
But yeah, we'll move on regardless. So I've been reading The Invasion of the Tealing, which is the sequel to Queen of the Tealing that I reviewed a few shows ago. Not sure how long it was, like a couple of months, I think.
Yeah, I think it was about, it was a few shows ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the sequel. We're back again following the protagonist, Kelsey Glynn, who has become Queen of the Tealing. She is now trying to rule. But because in the last book she decided she's not going to send any more slaves to the Kingdom of Mortments, which is like this big empire that borders the Tealing, they are of course now invading, hence Invasion of the Tealing.
Ah.
And she's kind of got to figure out a way to somehow fight them back, even though her army is completely outclassed. Although, interestingly, I think this is like one of the things I love about the book, it doesn't start off as that much of a one-sided fight, because the idea is that obviously Mortments is this huge empire that's conquered the land, but yeah. Because they've conquered it for so long, their army's kind of gone to pot a bit, so it's large, but it's not particularly well-trained, because obviously no one in the army, it's pretty much got to the point where no one really currently serving has had to fight any real battle.
Yeah.
So they're just all completely uncombat-trained. Whereas in the Tealing, they've had to be, like, solving internal disputes for years on end.
Okay.
So they're much more hardened, and they get some pretty awesome guerrilla warfare strategies. Like, literally the first chapter, they build catapults. And do you know what they put in the catapults?
What?
A big old sack with a parachute attached to it. What's inside the sack?
People?
Nope. Hundreds and hundreds of venomous snakes.
Wow.
And they just catapult them right into the enemy stronghold.
Nice.
Yeah, but obviously eventually just the sheer size of the army of Mortmens pushes them back. And Kelsey is soon looking at a siege of her capital city of New London. And while all that's going on, Kelsey is also discovering that she's got a degree of some sort of magical powers. Because in the last book, she discovered these two sapphires that belonged to her family. And they seem to have gifted her some sort of psychic powers. And means she's also having strange flashbacks to the life of a woman called Lily Mayhew. And this is where the book gets really interesting. Because it confirms what was hinted at in the last book. The Tealing is actually set in the very far future, because this flashes back to about 2058 in like the dying embers of American civilization.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, literally, the world, it's falling apart. There's this totalitarian government desperately trying to hold on to like the few families rich enough to live comfortably, where everything else is just like the mass poverty. People literally are living in forests now because they can't afford houses. And it's interesting trying to work out how this all leads to the Tealing. Like, even where exactly it's meant to be located.
Yeah.
Because they make some sort of reference to a journey. And but what does that mean? Yeah, it's a very interesting book. Its main thing is it tries to shy as far away as it can from all the typical fantasy cliches.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that. How Kelsey, in all her situations, like, she comes up against a lot of kind of attractive male antagonists. And she's like, that man is very attractive, but falling in love with him would be a terrible idea, so I'm not going to do that.
That's good.
Yeah, I like that. Just the fact that she can recognize that wanting to get all up in that guy's badonkadonk is not a strategically sound decision.
Yes, this is true.
Also, in this book, she discovers that she can flay people with her mind, which is kind of awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
She's a Jedi.
She's more like a Sith, to be honest.
Is she? Wow.
Yeah, because like, a lot of it also deals with the fact... It's basically that old adage of power corrupts.
Yeah.
And she's got to deal with having all this power and not letting it get to her.
Yes.
And it becomes very interesting, because there are also some chapters from the perspective of the Red Queen, who is the ruler of Mortmens.
Yeah.
As interesting to see just how very similar they're becoming.
Wow.
Yeah, because like, she's not even like this full-on, I'm the evil villain. She's basically someone who's built an empire entirely on fear.
Yeah.
And realizing, there are certain limitations to that. Because she doesn't actually want to invade the Tealing. Like, it's not like a strategically good area to own. She would rather like just have Kelsey run that and like work out some sort of trade agreement. But obviously, because her entire empire runs on fear, if she just lets Kelsey get away with not giving her slaves, that like her empire is going to collapse.
Yeah, because other parts of the empire will say, well, if they can do it, why can't we?
Yeah. And just everyone will start defying her.
Yeah.
It's a fun distraction from all the usual, especially the sort of young adult cliches, because this is basically like a young adult novel, but with more bite to it.
Why can't more young adult novels be like this?
I don't know. Like, I read things like Ember in the Ashes, where it's some simpering doe-eyed girl's like, the leader of the rebellion's so handsome, but will he ever notice me? Oh, but this guy, he works for the evil empire, but he's also so handsome. I hope he notices me as well.
Look at him with his sexy good looks and his smoldering eyes and his really, really pale, glittery skin.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing. But I don't even get it. Those guys aren't Oscar Isaac. Why are people in love with them?
He's still on the Oscar Isaac train.
I am still on the Oscar Isaac.
Train, I said. Train.
No, not even the train.
I said train as well. Okay.
Where we're going, we don't need trains.
Is it my turn?
Yeah, I'll sit here and fantasize about Oscar Isaac.
Okay.
I remember start doodling my name and his in my notebook.
Well, while you're going into Oscar Isaac Fantasyland, I'm going to talk about Tim Aker's book, which is book one of The Hallowed War, called The Pagan Knight. And I have to say, when you look at the cover, it is uninspiring, no matter what kind of blurb it says, because according to Publishers Weekly, this is emotionally involving epic fantasy. And on the back it says, from Simon R. Green, the New York Times bestselling author of Twilight of the Empire, says, it's an excellent page-turner, good, strong storytelling. And Gail Z. Martin, bestselling author, but doesn't say of what, says, a thrilling mix of intrigue and action. So when you look at this first, you don't really get a sense of whether the book is good or bad. You look at it and you look at the cover and the cover art of some guy shouting, some kind of Saxon type Celtic guy holding a sword and shouting, and he's got tattoos around his eyes and stuff like that. And you just kind of, well, I've seen that like how many times?
Yeah, it is exactly the kind of book that you'd see like in the W.H. Smith's of an airport as you're casually looking through holiday reading.
That's just based on the cover, though.
Yeah, that's entirely the cover.
Right. The magic happens inside, and it is, right? Because this is actually a really, really, really good read. And I've got a lot of respect for Tim Akers now because of what he's done with this book. And the problem is the cover really sells this book short. Really sells this book short. The story basically involves a north-south divide in what is kind of an English-type country during the kind of Celto-Romano period type thing, but more medieval. It's all kind of mishmashed together with historical references and fantasy references and stuff like that. Anyway, you have basically a country and it's separated into a north-south divide. In the north are the warlike Tenner, T-E-N-E-R, right? And in the south, you have the church-fearing and church-following Sudrin. And this tension between the north-south divide has been going on for a long, long time. The people of the north have their way of doing things, and they used to follow the old pagan gods. The Sudrin follow the celestial church, and they have accepted the belief in the celestial church and in the goddess Strife and the god Cinder. Cinder and Strife kind of work hand in hand with each other. Cinder is all about kind of wintertime and the moon, and Strife is all about summertime and harvest and war. And basically, the Church of Cinder and Strife, they have control over the Sudrin South, and they then have basically spread their belief into the North. And years ago, a war threatened to tear the land apart, which is now called the Reaver War. That has gone, that's faded from memory, everything has settled down, everybody's at peace. But into this, somebody appears, and he is leading a group of men who are going to attack the Sudrin, because the Sudrin, these are men from Tenna, the north, who are going to attack the Sudrin, but they don't realize that they've actually been duped by one of their own, one of the people who is actually among them. And the person among them who tricks them, he speaks like a priest, but he's not a priest of the celestial church. Instead, what he does, he murders a member who is distrustful of him called Tunny when they reach this kind of church-like, altar-like place. And he pierces him through the heart with a blade, and then basically he says some chants over him, and the heart is then taken over by this demonic force. And what appears then is a geist. Now, a geist is, they've spelled it G-H-E-I-S-T-S. Akers spelled it like that. And the geist, in this definition, for the purposes of the book, is basically an old pagan god who is no longer worshipped, and now the god has been reduced. You know the small gods from Discworld?
Yeah.
It's a bit like that, only in this case, the pagan god still has power to a degree, but that power has been severely reduced, and now they are so full of hate and anger and darkness that they are basically the equivalent of demons. They are a destructive force. And now one has been...
I like that idea a lot.
Yeah. Now one has been unleashed on the world in a way that hasn't been seen for a long, long, long time. Probably since before the Reaver War. there's a Geist roaming the land in kind of human form. And this Geist that was Tunny murders all of his, all of the team that was supposed to be doing this, you know, this rebel activity, we'll call it. And then everything kind of goes on to the next chapter. And in the next chapter, you have just a normal commoner going to the Allfire Festival at one of the nearest places. It's kind of a large village type place. And on his way there, he's going there with his daughter, on his way there, because he's going there because his brother is there, and nobody's heard anything from that village for about a week. And on his way there, him and his daughter, they're just kind of bantering, as you do, you know, father-daughter banter. And then all of a sudden, there's a shade comes out of the forest. His daughter's still not old enough to understand fully exactly what's going on. She thinks that these townspeople are just silly because the houses have no roofs, and it looks like the inside of a fireplace. Some of the houses look like the inside of a fireplace. And then this shade walks out the forest and says to the girl, "Don't be scared. You know, I'm a servant of Cinder, servant of one of the gods from Sudrin, one of the gods of the Celestial Church." And the girl is obviously scared. Her dad tries to attack, but this shade blocks it. Turns out the shade is actually a priest from the Church of Cinder, who is miles away, who sent his spirit ahead to see if the town is okay. They have been sent by the Inquisition of the Church to find out what the hell's going on, and they've detected traces of a Geist. So they are on a hunt now.
Yeah, well, that sounds pretty unexpected.
Yes, I know. So now you have the leader of the knights who were traveling with the priest is actually a woman. And the nice thing about this is she is called Sir as well.
That's cool. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking.
That seems to be something that's just like becoming more of a thing and stuff I've read.
Yeah. I mean, I like the gender equality aspect there because she is the leader of the knights and she is given the title Sir, regardless of whether she's a man or a woman. And I think that's a great thing to have. Anyway, moving the story on, you then go to the fort, home, manor house, castle, whatever it is, of Malcolm Blakely, hero of the Reaver War. And he's about to be visited by a high-ranking member of the church. His son Ian is training. And Ian and Malcolm, who were then later joined by a hunter called Gwen Adair, they become central figures in what happens in that land after the visit of the church official, because the land is about to be again plunged into chaos because of this one Geist, because this one Geist sets off a chain of events that nobody expects, and only a few have all but forgotten just the kind of damage that can be caused.
This is not the story that the book cover seems to offer.
No, it's not, and that's what I mean. The cover does not give this story any kind of justice. I'll tell you something, right? I've read quite a lot of fantasy books, quite a lot of kind of sword and sorcery and war-based fantasy books, and very few of them have actually encompassed the kind of Britishness, historical Britishness, that this one has.
Yeah, with like the Celts and the Romans and the what such and the what hows.
Well, it's not so much, they're not really Romans, it's just the Celestial Church that is very kind of Roman Catholic. Esque, but the fact that they have two gods instead of one, you know, they have Strife and Cinder as the gods, and the fact that you have the pagan north who worship like old gods who now worship the Celestial Church, and the old gods have been forgotten, but they're no longer worshipped, but it's not like they've been forgotten kind of thing. And then you have Malcolm Blakely and his son who are caught in the middle of all of this. And they basically have to try and save both the Sudrin and the Tenor from destruction, from chaos. And assisting them is the plucky Gwen Adair.
Because all fantasy novels must have some sort of character with the requisite levels of pluck.
Yes. Now, I like Gwen Adair as a character, but I've got to say, Ian was an interesting character, Malcolm Blakely's son, Ian. Because Malcolm Blakely is basically a duke, and he was given the title, and I love the way it describes him, because it says he's kind in iron voice, but he's reached the age where his muscle is turning to fat.
Oh, is he going to past his prime?
He's a little bit past his prime, and, you know, he's kind in iron voice, but his hands speak of war, you know, his body speaks of war, And I like the fact that he's a kind man. He's an understanding man. He's a very gentle man in every sense of the word. And that's why his wife Sasha loves him so much, because he didn't want to go to war. He doesn't like war. He saw enough of it during the Reaver War. And so he understands the need to prepare for war, because it could happen at any time. And so he's been trying to train his son, you know, combat ability, stuff like that. But his son has this whole kind of spoiled little rich kid attitude. Why do I need to learn a sword? I'm the Duke's son, blah, 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 kind of thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic.
You know, and so there's the relationship between Malcolm and his son, which isn't exactly the best relationship, because his son can't understand Malcolm, and Malcolm doesn't understand where he went wrong with his son at times, because his son seems like an idiot, and even the reader will agree his son is a bit of an idiot. But Ian does have good ideas from time to time as well, which catches Malcolm off guard. But he doesn't know how to kind of praise his son, because he's not used to being a dad, kind of thing. And I like the kind of rough and ready relationship the two of them have. The fact that they're both thrown into this conflict together, and they have to try and work their way through it as a team. And then you throw in the addition of Gwen Adair, and that just adds different dynamic to it, and it just makes it all really work, because there is some banter, but a lot of what happens between Malcolm and his son is the kind of cementing of the father-son relationship, but in a way that you don't quite expect, if that makes sense.
Well,
the thing is, it seems like what happens with this story after a certain point is that the conflict is still important. What's going on in the lands of Tenor and Sudrin is still important, but it kind of fades into insignificance compared to the relationship between Malcolm and Ian. And you find yourself rooting for the two of them. You're like, go on, you know, you can be a good dad. You can be a good son. You can understand your dad. Don't worry that you're surrounded by monsters. That kind of thing.
It's okay. The monsters aren't important. It's all about the family drama.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Which is one of the reasons, again, why I say the cover sells it short. Because the cover just says, oh, it's all about a fight. There's a guy holding a sword. It must all be about a fight. And it's not. It's so much more than that. And that's one of the reasons why I've really enjoyed reading it. So, yeah, The Pagan Knight.
Yeah, we've both had a couple of good books.
Yeah, I highly recommend this one to any sword and sorcery fan who likes their Celtic stuff, especially, because it really does work.
And I would recommend mine to anyone who's sick of the generic Twilight rip-off young adult fantasy novels.
Yes, definitely. Because my next one after this is Queen of the Teeling.
Oh, nice. You're going to see what I've been talking about.
Well, yes. You've sung its praises. I've got to see what you're talking about, though.
I have. It's a great book. Well, it's a book. Well, not Queen of the Teeling, but Invasion of the Teeling is a book in which the main character uses her brain powers to crush a man's lungs.
This sounds good to me.
It is all the good stuff we like.
The Pagan Knight is a book where, because the son has been bloody stupid during training, the mum picks up his sword and draws the blade across his palm to make him remember that he is flesh and blood and he almost kills someone.
Nice.
Actually cuts his palm open.
Ouch.
To teach him a lesson.
That is some tough parenting. I approve.
She's absolutely livid with him because he could have killed his instructor if he'd actually made a mistake. And so she basically tries to teach him. She shows him his own blood and says, that's what you got to remember.
Well, I know how I'm going to educate my children.
Maybe not that harsh. Anyway, yes. So that was Invasion of the Teeling, which is available from Bantam Press. And this one that I had was The Pagan Knight by Tim Akers, which is available from Titan Books, and both are out now. You can pick both of them up in all good bookstores, so do look out for them. They're very, very good. We are unfortunately at the end of the show, so we're going to have to leave you for another week, but we will be back next week with more fun and literary loiterings of our own. If you have enjoyed the show, then please do remember that the Geek Show Podcast Network is a voluntary organization. So please show your support by donating something using the button on the right-hand side of our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. Also on our website, you can find our shop. So as an alternative, if you want to buy something instead to support us, then you can. We have a range of merchandise on offer, and more will be coming in, more designs that are unique to us. You won't find them anywhere else, will be coming in over the next few weeks and months. So, yes, without further ado then, I am Rob.
And I'm Andrew.
And we will see you all next week.
Thanks for listening.